grease, steel, cracked iron, and bayou grass. Sun's heading creekside, days fading fast. Are you really digging for peace, or is that just a lie you tell to help you sleep? Sure that you.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire, and y'all are presumably still y'all. All are welcome here in the Church of Internal Combustion. We just ask that you show up with an open heart. Whew. Let's see if this works this time. My camera's giving me a little grief this morning. It stops recording every 10 minutes. I can't figure out what's going on with it. Hope you guys are having an excellent weekend. It is Sunday morning for me, about 10:30 in the a.m. now. It's been a busy week. Been a good, it's been a busy week. Not so much with comedy work. I did have shows last weekend. I was performing at the racetrack here in Houston, Sam Houston Racetrack Park, and a little frustrated with those guys right now. Still hadn't gotten paid for that gig, and they want me to go to San Antonio this weekend and do two more shows for them. And boy, I just I'm hesitant to drive my ass to San Antonio when I hadn't got paid for the last gig yet. So we'll see what happens. I'm looking forward to those San Antonio shows, but feeling a little sketchy right now about everything. We got a lot coming up, man. We got San Antonio this coming weekend, and then I'm going to go out to the Lemons on Sunday when I get back to San Antonio and go see my good buddy, Christian Mental Ward with the Everyone Racers podcast. They sponsored me most of my first season of the Wrecking Yard podcast, and they're a good bunch of people, and looking forward to getting to hang out with all my buddies I met last year at the Lemons event. I find myself in a strange position, and that government shutdowns have not affected me too much in the past. I've never worked for the federal government, never been in the military, never had to depend on anything from the federal government, aid and stuff like that. I mean, I've gotten aid and stuff before, but never had to deal with it during the government shutdown, and it's selfish, but by and large, it's never really affected me before. But this one is affecting me, funny enough. Some governmental policies are somehow getting through to my little universe and affecting me, and it's kind of strange. But my book, we're trying to get it out by fall of 2026, but now we got a hold up with all the printing. Because most of the books are printed in India, or at least a large portion of written manuscripts and books are printed in India. And because of tariff rates, and I don't understand it all, but basically it's stuff involving the tariffs on their end, is it's putting a delay on everybody's books getting printed, which is... it's a little strange to be dealing with. So you wouldn't think global politics would get in the way of getting a book printed, but apparently this is where we're at. On top of that, we're finishing up the ARCs. You know, the ARC's got to be done here in November. so we can start going through all the sub-right stuff. But when you get all those pages have to be copyrighted. Well, there's nobody working in the copyright office right now. Copyright office is shut down to essential employees, which means there's like three people there running the whole thing, and they're not doing any of that kind of stuff right now. So if they don't get the government back on track, we're going to be delayed on that. And that's just a weird, strange position to be in that I have not ever found myself in. Guess I should count myself lucky I hadn't been in that position yet. I'm sure it will resolve itself as things tend to do. And all the saber rattling ends and everybody figures out what they're going to get together on in that whole nonsensical theater that happens in Washington, D.C. Makes me irritated because I've had to read more about it than I've ever really wanted to. I just don't care for all that nonsense. Today's episode, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to talk about addiction quite a bit in depth and in detail about some things that happened to me and stuff I went through with opiates. And if that's triggering for you, or, you know, you're struggling with that, you don't want to hear that, I want to let you know that so you don't, you know, this might not be a good episode for you. I mean, I hate to see anybody miss one, but I understand, you know, it's a lot to think about sometimes. And I'm gonna try to be very honest about it. And sometimes honesty is not pretty. But I thought about it a lot this week, as a matter of fact, for two reasons. One of the things we've been doing with my book, so Adam, my editor guy, buddy, he teaches editing classes, developmental editing for the, I guess it's University of California, UCLA. And for the past two semesters, we've introduced parts of my book to allow his students to try to break it down and try to understand it and help kind of shape them as developmental editors and give them something to, you know, dig their teeth in, really gnaw on. And during the course of that, when we do that, so usually at least one class during that semester, I will sit in via Zoom and the students can ask me anything they want to ask me about the book and talk to me about themes and stuff like that in the first book, The Wrecking Yard. And it was very interesting last semester, but this semester in particular was really good feedback because it was not my normal demographic. Most of the students in the class are female and most of them pretty young, college students. So it was a real test to see that it does, will my book ring with these young ladies? Like, will they find something to relate to in it? And much to everybody's surprise, including mine, they related to it quite well. In so much as a lot of them are really excited about seeing the finished version of the book, and a lot of them are really excited about the second book, which gave me a great deal of hope. But two or three of them gals got in my head about something. They were going through the book and they said, you know, when you're obviously kind of healed and well adjusted now, but when you talk about some of the stuff you go through, you're almost kind of passive about it. You don't really get into the grittiness of like what actually they were specifically talking about drug use. And it just surprised me, I guess, because I grew up in the blue collar world, in the labor side of the blue collar world, and nobody ever asked me why I started doing drugs. That was a question I never saw coming. I don't know. Like, why? I did drugs the way most people did. I started doing them at work, and I got turned on to them through dudes I work with and family members and stuff like that. I don't know. It just kind of floored me. So I got to thinking about specific stuff I'd gone through. And then I tackled a project this week, and I haven't tackled a big project in a while, or at least big for me to be doing by myself anymore. But I decided to, y'all know, a few months back, we had some little kittens and they got killed by some stray dogs. When those stray dogs come in, they tore my porch all to hell, our screen porch all to hell, and did a bunch of damage to it. And there was also a bunch of damage done to it. Rachel's brother used to live in this house, and he's schizophrenic, and he did a lot of damage to this place. And also did a lot of weird electrical work. He's not proficient at electrical work, but for some reason he decided to mess with a whole lot of the electrical system of this house. And every once in a while I find fingerprints of crap he messed with, and I have to go in there and sort out whatever craziness he decided was how something should be done and fix it. And this isn't like your normal run-of-the-mill, like, oh, last guy worked on this, didn't know what he's doing, I'm going to come in here and set it straight kind of shit. Like, don't get me wrong, as a contractor, I've done plenty of that. But this is beyond anything. Like, to give you an example, when I first started working on this house, remodeling this house so my family could move into it, every time you turned the lights on in the kitchen, there was a buzzing sound in the wall. Now, that buzzing sound had never been, I've been to this house plenty of times, spent plenty of time over here working on stuff for grandma, and never heard that. But that all occurred after we removed him from the house, and I would go in the kitchen, there were, turn the light on, there was buzzing, there was hateful notes written everywhere and all kind of crazy stuff. But I kept hearing in the drywall in this one part of the kitchen, I kept hearing this weird sound, right? I said, boy, I don't know. Sounds electrical. And I could tell that he had cut some of the drywall and done something with the drywall and done a very poor patch in that kitchen. Because his drywall skills are about on par with his electrical skills. So one day I just decided to cut that drywall patch out. And what I actually found was like 8 patches all through the wall in the kitchen, where there once had been a, I think some kind of outlet, I don't remember. But he had literally just taken the black and the white wire and twisted them together and stuck them in a wire nut. Oh, they didn't even have a wire nut. They were just tucked behind the wall. He had decided that circuit wasn't energized anymore. And they weren't touching enough to make really good contact, but they were just enough to... This house was flipping breakers, doing all kind of weird stuff when I first got over here. And then I just found these 2 wires twisted up together, hidden behind drywall. Like, what the actual... I want to say the F word right there. But yeah. What? Who does that? So I had to retrace that circuit, of course, get up in the attic, figure out where that circuit was tied into, and where it was being energized. And it was a big old rigmarole before I got it all straightened out. And he had done a lot of weird stuff with the switches in there, and had also put some coffee mugs in the wall after he drywalled it up, which didn't, I don't know. I've never seen stuff. But so I tackled this other. So when those dogs came and demolished this porch, I knew I was going to have to redo it all at some point. But also in one corner of the porch, we had a bunch of termite damage. We were having all those termite swarms. Those termites got into some of those porch posts and eat them up. After we thought we had already killed all the termites, they showed back up. And I have my good buddy Tim Moss Wildlife Removal Services does pest control. He come out here and got rid of the termites for me. So I decided this week that I would go get some lumber. Actually, I wasn't even going to get some lumber. I had this great cedar lumber out here. I've told y'all the story of how I've drugged from place to place, and I thought I had it protected. And apparently termites eat cedar. I was living under a wives' tale. I didn't think termites ate cedar. I did not think termites were a fan of cedar because the terpenoids in cedar. But them termites ate the shit out of my good cedar. I ain't got much. I'm going to have to take it out there and cut it, cut what's good out of it, and plane it all down. But they did a number on some of my good cedar boards. So I ended up having to go buy lumber for this project, which was not something I was planning on doing. Buying lumber just sucks anymore. Like, it's always been kind of bad going to Home Depot and Lowe's for lumber. Like, you're going to get a lot of crap lumber. But I just went to get some 1x2 furring strips, which I know that's rough. You know, furring strips are rough stuff. I'm not expecting them to be pretty or trim level pieces of wood. But I thought, I can get some furring strips and use the backside, the square side of them to hold my screen down. It'll look nice. The old original trim on the porch is this real thin lath stuff. And it just doesn't hold staples or anything very well. And I wanted something that's going to have a little more substance to it, you know, as far as holding the screen up. But man, the lumber selection at our Home Depot was just awful. I bought two kiln-dried, treated 8-foot 2x4s, one 10-foot 2x4, and a 12-footer. And just saved myself some effort. I primed them and pre-painted them before I put them in. It like a couple days before I started the project, laid all the wood out, primed it, painted it, well-supported on... saw horses. No reason in the world that wood should have warped. Not a single reason in the world that wood should have warped. But that damn 12-foot and 10-foot 2x4 looked like silly string after about a day. It amazed me how badly it warped up. If you do any kind of carpentry work or anything like that, I know most people here are kind of car-oriented, but some of us do some carpentry and stuff. You know, working with crooked wood ain't no fun. This adds an extra level of frustration to the project. Something that should have been kind of easy. But on top of that, the inside of the porch is just dirty and, you know, 75 years of grime. I wanted to get in there and pressure wash it all out and everything, all that good stuff, and kind of start fresh with a new little space in there for us. Cleaned up really good, pressure washed the floor. All this is to get to a point, tell you, I just don't move as quick as I used to anymore on a job site. I'm a long way removed from young man used to get out there and build half a boardwalk in a day. I'm also not on the drugs I was on when I was doing that. It got me thinking when I was working on this porch, and I've told you all this story. The last time I worked on this porch was about a decade ago. It was right after Uncle Jerry died. Great Jerry. Uncle Jerry went in the hospital for what was supposed to be a routine surgery. And they were going to put a stent in. And he ended up, they nicked a vein. He ended up bleeding out. Uncle Jerry didn't make it through the surgery. It was devastating. It was a year after Rachel's father died. And then she lost her uncle, who was the only other big male role model in her life growing up. She lost both her grandfathers one of them at a young age, but the other one had dementia since she was pretty young, and she didn't really get to have much of a relationship with him. And so her father and Uncle Jerry were her big, you know, those were the guys. those guys. And Uncle Jerry thought the world, the sun rose and set on Rachel. He also thought that about my kid. He just loved my children. He's one of those people in my life I'm mad he's not around, because we just bonded really well. And me and him saw eye to eye on a lot of stuff that me and Rachel's father didn't always see eye to eye on, but me and Jerry had a little more in common. So anyway, right after Jerry died, Jerry had been talking to me about coming over and rescreening this porch for Grandma. He had all the screens cut out and had them ready to go. Had all the new screen material ready to go, rolled up, organized. And he had been feeling too bad to do it. And he had, pondered whether maybe I would come over and help him do it. And I was, as soon as you get feeling better, we'll knock that out. Well, he didn't get feeling better. So the day of the funeral, after the funeral, we had a little reception over here at the house, some food, and get together for the family. Instead of visiting with the family, I took it up on myself to rescreen that porch for Grandma, because sometimes those of us whose love language are acts of service, which I suspect mine in a great way is, I don't really have a problem expressing my love for people, but my favorite way to express my love for people is through acts of service. I wanted to do something for Grandma, and I couldn't do anything to make her feel better about outliving her two sons and losing the one who was... Uncle Jerry was like her caretaker. He lived here with her, and they had lived together for a great many years, and he had taken care of her, and she lost a lot with him. And I just wanted to do something for her. Like I said, it was about 10 years. Oh, it was 2016, 9 years ago. February. Getting close on 10 years. And I stood out there and I rescreened that porch for Grandma while everybody else ate chicken and hung out in the kitchen, swapped lies. And I thought it was kind of peculiar. None of those men offered to help. Not a single man in what was left of this family offered to help in any shape or form. But Grandma was out there with me the whole time while I worked on that porch. She stood out there and talked with me and watched while I worked on it and chit-chatted with me the whole day. She was just a special kind of woman. But she told Rachel that day, she said, his work is very neat. JW does neat work. And that always tickled me, because that wasn't an adjective anybody ever used to describe me or my work before, but it tickled me. But I remember how quickly I did that screen that day, just in a matter of hours. Now, granted, we kind of changed the design of the porch this time and everything, but I've been working on this porch for 4 days now. In between also working on the book and other stuff, My life's a little more compartmentalized now. I can't just devote a whole day to something anymore. I have to make content. I have to answer comments, that kind of stuff, do social media work. And, in between all that, find time to finish writing the book and write these every week. But I was out there working on that porch this week and just thinking about how my body moves differently and how things have changed since I first got into doing that kind of work, especially when I was doing it for a living. And I was thinking about what them girls said about, like, why did you get into drugs? And it made me think back to, like, what happened to me. What was it that spurred me to ever get on them damn opiates? And the truth of the matter is, it's because I got hurt. It's the same story for a lot of people who get involved with those particular types of drugs. They, I've got my Serbian chef knife, or whatever you want to call it, Amazon knife. I love his knife, but it's been dull for a while, and I kept meaning to go get it sharpened by somebody. But then I figured out a way to use my little rolling sharpener with it by putting my rolling sharpener on a higher plane, even though the blade's so tall that I could still use it. And so I'm going to work on that a little bit. I apologize for some of the noise in advance. I'm smoking some beef short ribs today, and I'd like to have my knife all ready to go when it's time to So I've told y'all the story. I don't remember exactly what year it was, but it was when I was working for Metco Industries. It was a testing company. And that's where I tore my back up the first time. That's where I tore a disc in my back while working for that company. And like a fool at the time, because I didn't know any better, I trusted the workman's comp doctors. And the workman's comp doctors gave me a bunch of Percocet and told me just to rest and come back to work in a couple weeks, everything be fine. I guess I just believed him. When a doctor hands you some pills, gives you a prescription, you think, you know, they're looking out for my best interest. Why should I take these pills? And I did. I took those Percocets, and those Percocets made me feel good. Made me feel not only like my back wasn't that hurt, hell, I felt like I could do more than I ever could before, like I could focus better. Get to work, I'd take one of them Percocets. Boy, I could shoot film all night, move heavy stuff around, get more done. Well, you get more done, you can take more hours. And when you can work more hours, you get more money. And that's a great deal of the motivation in the blue-collar world. How many hours can I work? How much money can I make? Took me a long time to realize I was getting fooled by myself. I remember when I first understood what it was that I was doing to myself was an old man that I knew and was sometimes a bit of a business mentor to me told me one day, Mr. Bob, he said, Jimmy Jerry, you know, a man can make a living with his hands. But to make money, you got to use what's between your ears. You ain't never going to make money with your hands. Your body's going to give out first. But you can make a living with your hands, but you're only going to make money with what's between your ears. And I wish that lesson had soaked in when he taught it to me. It sadly didn't. And for a time, I took those painkillers and I worked that job doing that x-ray work, and it helped me get by. I could climb towers. I could still work. I could still do things my body needed to do. Then after that, I got into comedy. And when I got into comedy, I didn't need to be able to do those things anymore. And I quit taking those pills. And I got into other things. Got into other drugs. Started drinking a lot. Drinking makes my back feel better. That's a true story. Or at least makes me not care so much about the pain. The pain didn't go away. I just found other ways to deal with it, but I also wasn't wrecking my body on job site anymore once I started doing comedy full time. I was still young and could sleep just about anywhere. boy, what I would give to go back for that. Not, I don't want to go back and be young again. But what I would give to be able to sleep like I did when I was 22 years old. To just lay down on a, I could lay down on the floor. I used to sleep sitting up in the truck seat. You know what I mean? I could do that now if I had to. I sleep in the wrong place in the wrong position now. I'm liable to wake up injured. A few years later, me and Rachel got married, got back in construction work. My back started giving me problems again. I went and saw a doctor. And that doctor prescribed me hydrocodone. And just like in Percocets, I take him hydrocodone, boy, I could go work all day. I never partied on them. It wasn't like a party thing for me. I didn't take them and drink. I didn't take them to have fun. But I took them every day. I took them every day. I would take four of them every day. Every day. Like clockwork. I could tell when my pill was wearing off, I need to take another one. I used to take one in the morning right before I go to work. And then I would bust. I would get there about 6 a.m. and I'd go hard till about 11:30, noon. And I'd go eat me a little bit of lunch, and I'd take another one of them pills, and I'd go hard in the paint till about 6:30, 7 o'clock. And then when I got in my truck go home, I'd take me another one of them pills. That way, by the time I got home, I wasn't in so much pain. I'd get on the floor, play with them babies, hang out with Rachel. Come about 9 or 10 o'clock, I'd take another one of them pills. An hour or two later, I'd be asleep and then get up 5:30 a.m. the next morning and do it all again. And in those days, I generally worked 6-7 days a week. I was trying to start a business. But in my early days, I had a helper here or there, but most of it was me. It was me unloading the wood trailers. Me. And I was taught construction, by a family that just didn't, you didn't take days off because you were hurt. You didn't take days off because you were sick. You just went to work. You just went to work. You had to go make that money every day. It becomes a need. And then pills were keeping me going. And you don't, when you're in the middle of that, you don't look so far into the future as to say, am I always going to have to take these pills? You don't think about that stuff. You just think, I need to work right now. I need to do this right now. Like I said, it wasn't, that's why I used to tell myself just right. This isn't recreational. You need this. But after a while, it gets harder to get them pills. Government started cracking down on them. They were having an opioid epidemic in Kentucky. They wanted to make these pills harder to get. So all of a sudden, regular doctors wouldn't prescribe these pills anymore. It got hard to get. I had to start buying them. People that sold pills. And those pills are a little bit more costly. So now you got to work more and make more money to buy the same medicine that allows you to do the work to begin with. Well, now you're using more of your medicine to work. And my buddy Steve at the time, I haven't spoken a lot about Steve in this particular era. This is about 2011. I'm in the throes of what I will call opiate addiction. I've been taking those pills off and on for 8 years at this point. And every time they were hard for me to get, I would try to quit them. I'd go, you know what? I'm just going to quit taking them. And then, God almighty, I'd be in more pain than I'd ever been in my life. And 2 or 3 days of dragging myself to the job site and getting behind at work and not hardly being able to do anything because I was in so much pain, I'd go hunting them pills again. And I don't know what it's like where you're at, but here in Houston, there was a solution. See, Houston had a lot of pill mills. And if you don't know what a pill mill is, I'll give you a basic explanation. You go see a pain doctor. I put that in quotations for y'all listening. You usually just look, pain doctors, chronic pain doctors, something like that. And you go see this pain doctor for this little bullshit exam, and they would prescribe you a cocktail, 3-pill cocktail. The most common one that I used to get prescribed was the hydrocodone for the pain, Soma, which is a muscle relaxer. A lot of wrestlers like using it. And then usually it was like Xanax or something like that, some kind of benzo, Valium or Xanax. Which now, knowing what I know, you shouldn't take any of those three drugs together. They're a bad I think one of those combinations is what, I don't want to say that, but I think Heath Ledger died from some kind of combination like that. I don't know 100%. It's a deadly cocktail. Those are not drugs you should be taking together. Benzos are terrifying, terrifying drugs. They're one of the few drugs like alcohol that can kill you if you just quit taking them. Your body develops such a physical need for it that it can kill you if you just quit taking them cold turkey. You need to quit taking them under a doctor's advice. Luckily, I never liked that. I never took those. I didn't want to feel down and run down. And Xanax just, I've taken one before and it just, I didn't care about anything and it knocked me out. It's not my type of thing. I also didn't like the muscle relaxers because I couldn't work. Couldn't take a muscle relaxer and work. And when I took them in the evening, they would knock me into such a deep sleep, I had a hard time getting up in the morning. So I would never even take those. But I would take those hydrocodones every day. And when you go to these pain doctors, they give you this prescription, then you have to go. It's basically a pharmacy run by somebody else in collusion with the pain doctors. You have to go to a specific pharmacy. It's usually not a very nice joint. It's not like going to Walgreens. You can't go get these prescriptions filled at Walgreens. You got to go to one of these pill mill pharmacies to get these prescriptions filled. And you have to fill all 3 prescriptions. And back then, I think to fill all 3 for a month's supply would cost me about $180, plus the doctor's visit was another $100. So you had to come up about $300 every month to go get these filled. But, you know, when I found these pain doctors, I thought, oh, well, now I got a solution. But because these things kind of work on the skirts of the law, and mostly on the outside skirt of the law, they would get shut down and reopened and shut down and reopened, and doctors fired and doctors would disappear. And half the time these doctors was on the pills too. And they would try to make it all. Usually this doctor was in a rough part of town. It was over in Channelview. It was somewhere you had to take a decent drive. There wasn't a lot of these doctors up in Montgomery County at the time. So I would have to leave Conroe about once a month, take a day off work, and try to get, you got to get to the doctor like 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. You want to be one of the first patients seen. See this pain doctor, because quicker you get your prescription, quicker you get over the pharmacist, you might get yours filled before they run out for the day, because they could only fill so many prescriptions in a day. And so you go over there early in the morning, leave an hour or two ahead of time, get over there early in the morning, pay your money, see the doctor, wait in line. And there was a lot of different people in these rooms, and I would think of them as junkie. I would think of them as drug addicts. I wasn't like them. I needed this medicine. I needed this medicine to work. I wasn't like them. These were just drug addicts in the way of me getting my medicine. Along with those people, you would have 5 or 6 girls in there getting a prescription, and there'd be a dude waiting for them outside. And the way this worked is he would wait for them outside, then he would drive them over to the pharmacy, he'd pay the doctor visit, pay for their pharmacy. Then they get their prescription, and he'd give them a little handful of pills to get them by. And then he'd take the rest and sell it. on the black market, dope market. So there's always a couple, handful of people like that in there too. And you could, these pain doctors were pretending like things were legit, but nobody was asking any questions. Then you go to the pharmacy. Sometimes the pharmacy is just a house. Like there was one I used to go to over off Calvagade. It was what we called it, a little yellow house pharmacy. And it was just in a neighborhood. And you go over there and there's bars all over the, you know, stuff. And you're just sitting in somebody's living room waiting to be called back and get your prescription filled. And they might mark it up. You know, sometimes it wasn't $108. Sometimes it was another, it was $200-something. Then I got to a point where my buddy Steve was taking all the pills. He liked the Soma. He liked all of it. And he had friends that he liked doing pills with. And so I would give Steve these bottles, these pills I wasn't going to take. And he'd go sell them and that we'd get some money back that I could put towards my next prescription. But it becomes a cycle. You become, I mean, I'm not, let me tell you something. The opiates will take over your brain. There's a reason. There's a reason so many people are addicted to them. There's a reason people will hurt themselves, physically hurt themselves, to go to a hospital and get some prescribed to them. There's a reason ER doctors have to watch out for drug addicts. Because people will physically injure themselves just to go in there and get them some pills. That's how good those pills are. And I'm telling you, when I took them, boy, I could work all day, dance all night. They let my body move again, gave me that freedom back. And you don't realize you're being controlled by something until you're steady off in the depths of it. You don't realize what a grip it has on your mind and your soul. To where every once in a while, when my pain doctors closed down, I'd be like, I ain't gonna take this mess no more. I ain't gonna live like this no more. And 3 days into that, I'd be in so much pain. Now I've lost 3 days at work. Now I gotta go take another day, go find another pain doctor, drive all over Houston, get my prescription filled. But by God, when you'd leave that pharmacy with that brown paper sack full of them pill bottles, you just felt so like, oh, it's going to be all right now. I just had to get my medicine. That's what you tell yourself. I just had to get my medicine. When I got my medicine, I can go to work. Now I'm going to work double time. Now I'm going to take on extra jobs to make up for this time I lost. You start mortgaging tomorrow for today. And I mortgaged a shit ton of tomorrows for today's. For days that I needed to carry wood up 2 flights of stairs and rebuild a balcony by myself. For days that I needed to run an alligator off. For days that I needed to be able to do stuff that I couldn't do without them pills. For days I needed to be able to work like Superman. And that was every day. Pouring concrete by myself. Mixing concrete by myself. Pouring sidewalks. Finishing sidewalks till 9 o'clock at night. You start justifying it, man. It's real easy to justify. I got to have this. It's the only way I can provide my family. You don't look at it as I'm taking anything away from my family. It's I got to have this. It's the only way I can support my family. I got to have this. And I imagine there's people that do drugs for all kind of reasons. Not all pain is physical. In fact, I think most people that really mess with any kind of intoxicant, most of the time are looking away to ease some pain. Whether it's emotional pain, traumatic pain, or actual physical pain. But you can read story after story after story of people getting addicted to opiates in particular because of hurting themselves on the job site or a dental procedure. Them factory drugs is good. Factory drugs is real good. They get a hold of you. You don't even realize they got a hold of you until you're off in it. So you're being owned by these things. And then it gets to the point where it's just a cycle. Every month you're out hunting these pills. And you're dealing with nefarious characters because sometimes you can't find a pain doc. Sometimes you got to go find one of these guys and sell you some pills. Now you're paying $2, $3 a pill. I don't know how it happened so easily. But at some point, I can tell you by 2011, I was living on these things. And when I couldn't get them, I'd shut down. Hell, I remember one time I went so far as I met some people. I don't know how they did it. I assume they robbed a pharmacy. But sold me a big, like the pharmacist bottle of these pills. And I scrambled to get the cash to do it because I needed them. Because I had to have them. And then they just become a part of everything. Like, you got to take them every day. And they start... And the thing is they're not really fixing the pain. They're just masking it. They're just masking the pain. So while you're doing all this crazy building stuff, I've talked about this before, you're just doing more damage yourself. And I've seen good men, contractors, doctors. I know a judge that ruined their lives over these pills, that threw away everything they had worked for to keep getting these pills. And not everybody gets away from it. I was fortunate. I got away from it. And I've told you, when my mother was dying at such a young age of liver failure, I was like, I'm not going to end up in this boat. I got to do something about this. I'm not going to be 57 and leave my kids alone in this world because I couldn't get off these damn things. And I broke the spell and got free from them, but it was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. And you tell yourself stuff to justify it all the time, but let me tell you, my inner monologue was still telling me all the time, you're a junkie, you're a drug addict. You ain't worth a shit. You can't do anything for anybody unless you take this pill, put this pill in your body. And I'd say, no, I need this. I got to have this for work. I'm in pain. I'm in pain. I got to have this. But that inner voice the whole time is talking to you. You tell yourself, You make constant justifications. I look back at it now, I can hardly believe it. And here's the thing is, once you're in the grips of them, time slips by. What was a year is now 5 years. And you look up and you're still doing the same thing. I've been taking those pills for nearly a decade when I walked away from them. When I crawled away from, that's the most pain I've ever been in my life, breaking that habit. You know, it affects with you the way your body makes dopamine, all these chemicals, and your body stops making all that stuff. And so there's no pain relief after you get off of them. It takes forever for your body to start making chemicals the way it should again. I see people now still trapped in it, still stuck behind that little devil that's trying to get them. Bothers me. bothers me that something like this was ever available, you know, with these kind of long-term consequences that come with them. But, you know, nothing gets in the way of money. And if there's money to be made off something, people are going to make money off of it. I hope none of you are struggling with anything like that. Chances are maybe some of you are. And if you are, I just want you to know that you're not alone. I've been in that position. And it's I know about all the stuff we tell ourselves. I know all that. I know about the lies we constantly tell ourselves to make it seem like what we're doing is okay. When I thought back about those days, about going to those pharmacies and going to those pill mills, and how degrading that experience was, and how I would try to convince myself that I was better off than all the other people doing it with me. Oh, they're just doing it because they won't get high. I'm doing this because I need this. I got to have it, you know. I'm not like them. Those are drug addicts. I'm just working man. And I guarantee a whole lot of working men have told themselves that lie right up until it killed them. Whole lot of them. It's that old Tyler Childers song, "Keep your nose on the grindstone and out of them pills." They were so bad up there, man. They were so bad up there that they caused a heroin epidemic in Kentucky when they took them. You can't just take something like that off the market. When you take something like that off the market, nobody can get it. They're just going to find a substitute. And apparently that black tar heroin's a good substitute, or it was a cheaper one. But at the end of the day, I think I think the most important thing you ever know is people will actually hurt themselves to get them. That tells you everything you need to know about that particular little drug right there. People hurt themselves to get it. People do strange things to keep that feeling, to feel good. I remember my favorite lie that I used to tell myself was I wasn't addicted to drugs. I just needed to work. I just needed to work. It wasn't about taking drugs. It was about going to work. That's all I really needed. Let's wrap that one up there for today, and let's do some testimonials. I got some pulled up. I got one in particular. Well, where did I put them? Oh, here we go. At Drifting Hobbies 277. Is that a Thor hammer necklace? I'm new to your podcast, but I would love to hear the history behind it in one of your videos one day. I did it. I answered this, Philip. I thought I'd answer it. Every once in a while I get questions about my necklace. It's a... I'll take it off so you guys can see it. It's a Celtic axe necklace. It's got a, I don't know if you can see right there, it's got some knot work and Celtic knot work on it. And it's made out of silver. And my wife gave me this as a gift after the birth of my oldest kid about 15 years ago. And it was supposed to, at the time, it had a little card said it symbolized excellence in all endeavors, but particularly those of the family variety. And I very rarely take it off. That time I took it off just now to show it to you guys is probably the first time I've taken it off in a year or so. I wear it all the time. It's just one of those connections to her and the kids and a different time. Also, at the time, I was under the impression that I was mostly Irish, ethnicity-wise, but since then, I've done some DNA testing and found out that I'm mostly Scottish. Very, very little, I think it's like 30% Irish and 70% Scottish and Wales. But not nearly. I was told all my life that the McBrides were all Irish and all that good stuff. And they were, but everybody else in my family heavily Scottish descent. I was also told that we were Cherokee Indian, like every other redneck in the South. But my DNA test didn't show none of that. So it looks like I used to joke with people. I come from the whitest people I ever whited. It was a bunch of crackers over in Scotland crackering around, and then they crackered over to Virginia for a little while, and then they crackered off into Appalachia, and then some of them crackered off into Texas. But it was just this long line of crackering farmers from Scotland, mostly farmers. Yeah, that's a story. It's not much of a story behind the old Celtic axe. Oh, it's a little chilly out here this morning, garage. Might should have worn me a jacket. At our old buddy, the Balding VW. Sorry I haven't been on the live show in a long while, brother. No, I still listen to every single episode, but life is busy. I hope you're doing well, and I can't wait for you to announce a Pensacola or a Foley, Alabama show. Still want you to show up at OWA. Buddy, don't worry about missing the live show. I love when you guys come sit and we talk in the chat and all that good stuff and watch the show together, but this show's for y'all whenever y'all need it. I'm just happy you're still listening to all the episodes, and I hope all your projects are going well. And though the Pensacola show wasn't able to work out, we were trying to put that together with the Louisville show, and that just didn't pan out, and I'm glad because my hip wouldn't have been able to handle all that driving or everything I was going on with my hip at the time. But I will be in Macomb, Mississippi here in about 2 weeks. I don't know how far that is from you, but I will be in good old Macomb, Mississippi at the Palace Theater. I'm going to the home of the great one, Jerry Clower. Going to Liberty County, Mississippi. I'm going to go pay my respects at the final resting place of the great Jerry Clower. I may even write a whole special episode around that because Jerry Clower is just a good portion of what inspires me to tell stories the way I do. Of course, been a fan of Jerry Clower for many, many years. And never been out there, so I'm hoping maybe I can go over there and check out. I know that the museum's not open anymore, but I've reached out some people, and I'm hoping maybe I'm going to get to go over there and see that museum. I'm also going to run over and see the crash site from Lynyrd Skynyrd's plane crash. One of the guys involved with this show is real familiar with it, and he's offered to take me over. He writes for the newspaper there. I just did an interview with him a couple days ago. I'll be coming out any day now. Also, just recently did an interview, not about comedy, but about planned obsolescence and inflation with the Guardian newspaper. So that'll be coming out here pretty soon, too. And I'll post that on all my platforms. Yep, so we got a lot coming up. Let's go. All right, here's the last one. Oh yeah, I brought this up because I want to answer. At Jeffrey Palmer 7294, I'm beginning to feel duped. I think you are a liberal with a beard after many times listening to you. Nothing personal. That's just how I see you. I have so many questions about this statement. But I think it's a sad state of affairs. When a message of kindness is mistaken for a political affiliation or movement. First of all, I don't think any of the political movements right now are shrouding themselves in kindness. I don't give a shit what side of the fence you're on. Nobody's shrouding themselves in kindness. My message is one of kindness. I mean, though you made it clear that you may have watched and listened to my content, you didn't hear a word I said. I don't take it personally, though. It's not the first time, surely will not be the last time, that someone trapped in a false paradigm is going to label me to satisfy their own longing for order in a chaotic world. I get plenty of hate mail from the entire political spectrum telling me how I fail them on a weekly basis. I have liberals calling me MAGA. I have MAGA people call me liberals. It's just so funny. You know what? I'm rooting for you, Bubba. I hope you break free of that someday. I hope you experience the right kindness and the right moment that allows you to grow past whatever it is you're afraid of. It's hard. I've been there. I used to be flag-waving this person that didn't have a clue what I was talking about as well. And it's hard for me to take something personal when I don't think you know what you're talking about. I'm not sure. A liberal with a beard? That's a weird insult. Do you mean like Walt Whitman? Frederick Douglass? Abraham Lincoln? Jesus? Which liberal with a beard? It's the weirdest thing. It's just I think liberal is a word some talking head told you to be scared of. Whether it's one of these guys sitting in their pickup trucks making videos about how everybody's wrong, or one of these dudes on TV in a gray suit making hand gestures. So don't take it personally. I just think you don't know what you're talking about. Whoops. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. Yeah, that was a weird one. That floored me. That liberal with a beard thing. That's the funniest thing. Like, what do you even mean, bro? There's been a lot of them. Hell, and then there's like such a breakdown, like, you know, I always wonder if people even know what a classic liberal is anymore and what that means. I think it's just, I think we use words wrong for so long that they don't even have a meaning anymore. It's, seems more and more commonplace these days that people just throw these words out there and don't have a clue what these words mean or what they're supposed to be. Anyways. Wrap this thing up. Get out of here for the day. I'm going to go finish cooking my ribs and working on that porch without the aid of painkillers. Which, let me tell you, JW's a lot slower without them. But that's all right. At least I have control of myself now. You know, the devil don't come in an angry man. He comes in charismatic, gregarious, helpful even. The devil's usually trying to fix your problems or show you a way around them. And I'll tell you something. The devil ain't a who. It's a what. It's that quiet part of yourself that whispers yes to things you used to know were wrong. Just to keep the peace. Just to keep the comfort. I wasn't addicted to drugs. I was addicted to not being in pain. I had myself convinced that was the truth of it. Different kinds of pain out there. The kind that breaks your bones and the kind that sets fire to the parts of you no one else sees. I'd tell myself that while I sat in them pill mills, waiting on my little paper sack of relief, feeling I was inexplicably better than all the other junkies waiting with me. But the truth is, I was one of them. Didn't matter how I dressed it up, it was the same devil in a different coat. It was mostly physical for me. I tore up my back working for a company that paid me just enough to keep me loyal and broke me just enough to keep me quiet. I took workman's comp instead of justice, and that's a deal with the devil right there when you trade pain for a paycheck. I didn't chase a high. I chased a clock in. I chased a chance to ruin myself a little more to make other people happy, to prove I was a man, to prove I had value. And ain't that the lie that most of us fall for? We call it work ethic, but that's just a fairy tale they taught us to keep making money off our backs. And then it got to where I spent more time working to buy and find the pills than I did taking them. That's when there's a quiet, plaintive, soft-spoken fella telling you that you got a lot of work to do next week. It's going to be hard to do if you're hurting. Anybody with any sense can look in the mirror and say it plain. I can't keep taking these things forever. They don't even work as good anymore. This story only ends two ways. You leave it behind or it leaves you behind. Bloated, your body, your soul, malnourished, cold and quiet after you've run off anyone who ever gave a damn. That's the crossroads. Ain't no altar choir, ain't no altar call, ain't no choir. Just you, the mirror, and a choice. It don't feel like one, but you got a decision to make. You get off the train, you try to figure out where you are. Or you throw more coal on the fire and make your way to Valhalla. I ain't here to preach at you. I'm just telling you that I made it back. Pain's still here, sure. Some days I can't hardly walk. But it's honest now, and it don't own me. And, church, that's the only kind of miracle I believe in anymore. I'm rooting for you. Each and every one of you. We don't have to agree for me to root for you. You don't have to fix everything tomorrow for me to root for you. You don't ever have to solve any of it for me to root for you, but I'm rooting for you because all along there was a few people that rooted for me, and I know what it's like to have somebody in your corner. By God, I'm in your corner. I'm JW and I love you. Better off than we was. Oh, I bet tell you about this rooster. back here on this property behind us. See, back here in the back of our neighborhood, it's just kind of like small streets and a lot of open space. And there's this fella over there that lived on one of these back streets, had a whole bunch of chickens and a couple of roosters. And they just kind of wandered around out in the ditch, all that stuff. Well, there's a lot of gentrification going on in the back of our neighborhood. So back there, right across from his property, somebody has built a whole bunch of condos and started developing that side of the street. Well, now he can't let his roosters wander the streets anymore. I don't know what they've done to this rooster, but they have broke this rooster, because this 50 cock-a-doodle doos from 6 in the morning till 3 in the morning. Just all day long, this dude just... And you can just hear him all day long. Like, every once in a while, I hear a gunshot over there, and I assume somebody has shot themselves so they don't have to hear that rooster anymore. He just goes nonstop. This rooster, he's been going the whole time. But I was out here at 2 a.m. last night on the porch hanging out, and he was still going then. And he sounded so tired. Like, can a rooster cock-a-doodle-doo themselves to death? I don't know, but I think this will. We've about decided he's protesting the new development. I suspect they've locked him up in a coop away from his hens. Anyways. Now he's going to do it again because I'm talking about him. Boy, he was going all day yesterday. I was outside all day. All day I could hear this fool. Well, it's time to go smoke some ribs. Finish this daggum porch.